This message comes from NPR sponsor Hulu. Don't miss the new docuseries, Black Twitter, A People's History. From memes to movements, see how this powerful online community shapes culture and society. Black Twitter, A People's History is now streaming on Hulu.
Godzilla has been around for 70 years, appearing in dozens of Japanese films and a handful of American ones. He recently won his first Oscar, well, the filmmakers did, for the visual effects for the beloved Japanese production Godzilla Minus One. And now the Hollywood MonsterVerse franchise rolls on with Godzilla Kong, the new empire. As the title suggests, it once again pairs Godzilla with King Kong, as the two face a common enemy. And also Mothra's in there, and possibly a new Ice Age, and it's a real mess. I'm Linda Holmes, and today we're talking about Godzilla Kong, the New Empire, and Godzilla Minus One on Pop Culture Happy Hour from NPR. Joining me today is writer and critic Walter Chow. Welcome back, Walter.
Thank you so much for having me.
And also with us is Jordan Morris. He is a podcaster, and his upcoming graphic novel, Youth Group, is available for pre-order now. Hello, Jordan.
Hi, it's great to be here.
So I want to start with the new movie just because it's new and listeners might be curious if they should check it out this weekend. So first of all, I want to clarify, the studio says that the X in the title is silent. So the title is Godzilla Kong, the New Empire. That's why I keep saying that. Don't ask me. It's part of this MonsterVerse that started with the 2014 film Godzilla. After battling in the last movie, Godzilla versus Kong, they are now working together as a new threat emerges. The new empire finds Godzilla living above ground and Kong living in what they call Hollow Earth. Rebecca Hall plays scientist Eileen Andrews, and Kaylee Hottle plays her daughter, Gia. They team up with Bernie, a podcaster, blogger, conspiracy theorist, played by Brian Tyree Henry. Some other titans, as they call them, participate, probably most notably Mothra, because the point of this movie is to set up additional movies. Jordan, I have heard through the grapevine that you had a good time at this movie. Tell me about the good time that you had.
Yes, I would love to. I'm glad we're talking about both of these kaiju movies in the same episode, Godzilla Minus One and Godzilla Kong, whatever subtitle. You know, the Godzilla movies started out kind of more somber, satirical, you know, meditations on the horrors of war, and they eventually became these kind of cartoony, campy, fun, late night movies. And I love the fact that we can now have both. Godzilla Minus One is a little more of the kind of original vision of Godzilla. It's meditative. It's a little bit sad. And Godzilla Kong is pure insanity. I had a blast. It's goofy. It's fun. If it doesn't sound like your thing, it is probably not your thing. Godzilla Minus One, I would say, hey, even if you don't love these kinds of movies, maybe check this one out. It's right. Special. It's beautiful. Godzilla Kong, I don't know. I just had a blast. And who doesn't love the fact that there's a heroic podcaster who saves the day?
It's true. I mean, he does go off to Hollow Earth without apparently a microphone, which is right. A little strange. He takes his little camcorder.
Sure, the camcorder is a weird choice.
It's interesting because I am not necessarily a big monsters fighting each other guy. That's not really my genre. And it's interesting what you say because I sort of watch this and I feel like I've seen every shot in this movie before, despite not really being the person who watches a lot of these movies, I feel like. Although I did see the 2014 Godzilla. So I just feel like it made me actually think about, I was rereading Walter's review of the 2014 Godzilla, which was a very positive review, and reading a thing about how it's very important that human beings are involved when the monsters are fighting or when they're rampaging, because essentially the gods have to be able to see us or else the universe is indifferent and doesn't care about us and nothing matters. And I did notice there are a lot of fights in this movie where it's just monster fighting.
Yeah.
There's no people anywhere. And it's not even a lot of it taking place in cities or anything like that. I feel like about every 5 minutes in this movie, they unveil a new place for fights to happen. And people are constantly kind of looking on in awe as a new space is discovered. So, Walter, my guess, having read your review of the 2014 Godzilla, which you liked, and some other Godzilla movies that you haven't liked, is that you probably did not enjoy this movie too much. So talk to me about that.
I found it to be really painful. You know, I don't want to be such a killjoy. Jordan is such a ray of light. You know, I want to be where Jordan is. But, you know, when Jordan's talking about the origins of Godzilla, yeah, you know, it came out in 1954, I think the first movie by Honda Ishiro. And when it was released in Japan, the design of the monster, the scales and the burns on his skin were meant to replicate the burns of survivors of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Very serious stuff. And all of a sudden you have this monster woken up by the actions, the ill-thought-through actions of man, destroying Tokyo, destroying cities, and leaving this sort of waste of trauma behind them. You know, initial audiences, by contemporary reports, in Japan left the theater feeling really shaken and upset because they recognized this was their story being told, you know, metaphorically. When it was transplanted to America, Jordan mentions, you know, correctly that, you know, there's a campy side to Godzilla. Well, that's because of the Americans, mostly the beginning. They recut it. They added a Raymond Burr framing story. They made it a thing where we can make fun of it, where Godzilla's running and a bunch of Asian people are running in terror before him. So there's some really serious stuff here, as well as with King Kong, there's really serious stuff in our history. There's a lot of racial stuff that's attached to that too. So here we have this product of two colonial influences that are American teaming up or fighting with each other or whatever. And I'm such a killjoy. I'm so sorry. But yeah, you know, when they begin to destroy cities and they destroy the Great Pyramids and they destroy, there is such a toll of human life that we're not talking about. To an extent, you can disassociate when people are being murdered in mass. And then there's an extent, I think, that some people can't anymore. The timing of this for me, it's really, really difficult. Mm-hmm. I find it to be irresponsible. I've found this series to be generally irresponsible. But, you know, and then it's got all these needle drops to make it kind of a James Gunn kind of fun movie. Mm-hmm. And now suddenly I'm kind of relating it to Vietnam, too.
And they do that in Kong Skull Island, too. There are a lot of references around, like, the music that people think of as, like, what pop culturally has become the Vietnam War. So that's a... I think all this makes sense to me.
Yeah, indeed, if it makes sense, it makes sense for that. But this one, you know, it's not set in sort of that environment. And also the Asian characters in this are not given a voice. One literally is voiceless, played by the Chinese actress Fala Chen. And she just represents sort of this mystical Earth child that they have already.
Right.
These are very difficult stereotypes for me to overcome. You know, it doesn't have to be about that. It really doesn't.
Yeah, it's interesting because we've had these conversations about kind of mass death in the context of other blockbusters sometimes. I remember noticing this in one of the Star Trek movies, kind of has massive kind of destruction of cities. And it's like, and even like, you know, some of the Marvel movies have this, most of them don't, but some of them do. And one of the things I kind of liked about the way they eventually did it in the Marvel movies is that at least they went back to it. At least it kind of had consequences that people were traumatized and stuff like that. And I sort of have mixed feelings because on the one hand, the people in my screening were having a really good time. Like I said, this is not necessarily my thing. But I don't, you know, I don't begrudge people a good time. And I definitely don't begrudge, you know, like Jordan being somebody who's like, I thought this was fun. I like big monsters fighting. I'm curious, like, what do you think about when you hear that, Jordan?
Yeah, I think these are all valid, good criticisms. And yes, and I think I maybe don't have the smarts to talk about this properly. But I also did have some feelings when we got to the kind of tribe of people who live in the center of the earth. They look very cool. There's cool designs. I think they're cool characters. But, you know, and I think when you go back and look at the King Kong movies, they have, you know, some icky stuff around. Yes. And again, am I the guy to talk about this? No. But I did acknowledge that. And I totally understand seeing that in a movie and feeling a little icky and like maybe they're using some tropes irresponsibly. So I absolutely understand that. And yeah, you know, I think the, you know, monster fighting is neat and cool. I like the fact that Godzilla has eras. He's like Taylor Swift in that way. And we can have different kinds of movies featuring these characters. But I also think that if you feel icky about some of the icky stuff, that is very reasonable.
Yeah. I think it's really interesting how this entire lore has been so malleable. And you have kind of this more serious, more kind of, I don't know, tethered to real events and tethered to real trauma and feelings tradition of films. And you also have these humongous blockbuster movies. And if we turn to Godzilla Minus One, which came out in 2023, it got excellent reviews. It made great money. It won an Oscar for visual effects, as we mentioned. And I'm in a weird position here because I did not see that movie when it came out. And it's currently in that kind of weird dead zone where it's not in theaters, but it's not available to watch at home. So much to my dismay, I have not seen it yet. Fortunately, you have both seen it. That one is a Japanese production made to celebrate the franchise's 70th birthday. It's from the writer, director, and visual effects supervisor, Takashi Yamazaki. And unlike the Hollywood MonsterVerse, this is sort of what we've been talking about. It restores sort of Godzilla's connection to World War II and also Godzilla's connection to Japan, both of which are essentially broken in the Hollywood kind of MonsterVerse telling. Walter, what do you think it was about Godzilla Minus One that captured people so fully? Because I started hearing about this almost as soon as it came out.
You know, I think it's really humane. It's sort of the flip side of Godzilla Kong, for me anyway. And I want to be sure that I say that I love Godzilla movies. I love the Toho films. I love the Showa era, which this, you know, new movie is really beholden to, where, you know, the monsters are different colors and they can do different things and there's no rules really. My favorite Godzilla movie is Destroy All Monsters. I adore those movies. I adore them. But they were always grounded, I think, with the sort of humanity, this essential hopefulness that we have, that these gods that appear out of nowhere with the power of our lives and deaths have some meaning for us and have some kind of awareness of us. And I think the beauty of Godzilla Minus One is that it presents trauma, post-war trauma specifically, as a tangible thing, as a manifestable thing. So that throughout the course of the film, as they're talking about, we must do this with Godzilla, we must do this with Godzilla, you really know what they're actually talking about. We must do this with the terrible things that I've seen. We must do this with the humiliation that we've suffered as a nation and our very identity, always in regards to this great, crazy, nihilistic force of destruction that we maybe have something to do with introducing into the world. It's like an Oppenheimer in a way, and really timely for last year, where we're kind of really kind of considering what we've wrought upon the planet and how we get out of it. How do we get out of this? It gained a lot of momentum, this movie, because people who aren't usually, you know, kaiju guys were maybe seeing it or being dragged to see it by their kaiju friends who said, look, I went to this for a lot of cheap laughs. I'm coming out of this really shaken and moved. I think you would actually like this.
That's exactly what I was hearing.
Yeah, and it is actually good. It is remarkably good. The humanness of it, there is a destruction of a city in the middle of it that is among the most devastating things that I've seen for a while. And it sounds like not fun, but it kind of is what I needed. I needed people to take this seriously. Godzilla Minus One, man, the budget must have been like a fraction of the budget of this MonsterVerse movie. And it is so elegant and beautiful and real feeling. There's more gravity, like physical weight in that movie than in any, I think, 5 minutes of the MonsterVerse movies.
Interesting. Jordan, you also liked Godzilla Minus One.
Yeah, I loved it for all the reasons you mentioned. And I think it's worth talking about their use of special effects. They won the Oscar for visual effects, and they use them so judiciously, right? You don't see as much Godzilla in this movie, you know, in the American ones. He's kind of like Jaws in this movie. He kind of sneaks up on boats, and he comes out of the darkness to snatch people. And That's really amazing because it makes him scary again. I can't remember the last movie I've seen where I've been scared of Godzilla. It just makes for a really fun monster movie. Yes, it is not campy, it is not silly, but the horror is real, the destruction is real. And yeah, I think Walter mentioned, yeah, there is some, you know, cities getting leveled by atomic fire and stuff like that, but it's played really real and you see the humans reacting to it. You know, something else I loved about it, it's a really focused story. It's basically the story of one man. It's the story of a guy who was a kamikaze pilot in World War II and couldn't go through with it. And he's living with this guilt. And when Godzilla comes up, he kind of has this chance to redeem himself. And there are some really fun side characters. There's a little kid character. And they're all really cool and fun. But it's basically his story. And I think that, like, the American movies get so overstuffed with actors and plot lines. And this team is going to this place. And the other team is going to the other place. And they'll meet in the middle. It just gets so complicated. As much as I like some of the actors in, you know, Godzilla Kong, you know, you don't remember too many of those human stories. But this one, because they focus on one man, it's really impactful. And I totally remember his story.
I think it's really amazing to me the way that they echo sort of the Pacific theater in a way. It begins on a small island. It proceeds to the town of Ginza. And then he's headed towards Tokyo. And it's up to these Japanese soldiers, these veterans of a recent war, to figure out a way to stop it, to save the homeland again. It's almost like they're reenacting trauma, reenacting the sort of cycle of violence that we've recently been through, and trying to relitigate or refight that so that we can have some kind of closure with it. This is the 70th anniversary of the original, and they really wanted, I think Toho really wanted to say, hey, let's go back and really kind of examine what the roots are of this creature, what it meant to our culture, and let's go there. And I was really especially moved by how the last few lines of the film, and it's not really a spoiler to share it, to say, you know, it's about life, it's about living. And so the sort of like death obsession that we have and the crush and all the, you know, that's kind of mitigated by the end of it, where it's just two people talking to each other, talking about the importance of surviving. That's beautiful. That's really beautiful. And it's not cheap at all for me.
Yeah. Well, and I got to say, like, when I was watching Godzilla Kong, I had the feeling that it was very early in the movie, the first time that you see Kong sort of do that close-up shot with the face roar, you know, that I guess is sort of the iconic Kong shot slash Godzilla shot. And I was kind of expecting them to like hold that close-up face shot for later. But no matter how many times they did it, the people in my theater loved it every single time. At one point, like they just go, one monster goes rah, and then the next one goes rah, and then the next one goes rah, and they clap and clap and clap, and everybody's happy. And like, that's cool. But for me, one thing that I'm kind of taking away from this conversation about Godzilla Minus One is that when you don't go as over the top for the kind of the big monster fight parts of it right out of the gate, you have an opportunity to have a movie that has some shape, as opposed to something where like everything is just, I don't know, on full thrash from the minute that the lights come up, because it's that kind of movie.
Yeah.
All right. Well, tell us what you think about Godzilla Kong and Godzilla Minus One. Find us on Facebook at facebook.com/PCHH. Up next, what's making us happy this week?
This message comes from NPR sponsor Homes.com. You don't just live in your home, you live in your neighborhood as well. So when you're shopping for a home, you want to know as much about the area around it as possible. Luckily, Homes.com has got you covered. Each listing features a comprehensive neighborhood guide from local experts. Everything you'd ever want to know about a neighborhood, including the number of homes for sale, local amenities, and even things like median lot size and a noise score. Homes.com. We've done your homework. This message comes from NPR sponsor BritBox, helping people discover a world of British TV, including new original drama Time, starring Jodie Whittaker, Tamara Lawrence, and Bella Ramsey. Streaming at BritBox.com/NPR. Support for NPR and the following message come from Sattva. Sattva luxury mattresses are every bit as elegant as the most expensive brands, but because they're sold online, they're about half the price. Visit SAATVA.com/NPR and save an additional $200.
Do you ever wish you could get your stories in 3 hours rather than 3 minutes? Or maybe you're sick of doom scrolling, getting your news in bits and pieces. That is where Embedded comes in. We bring you documentary series that will change the way you think about things. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.
Now it's time for our favorite segment of this week and every week. What's making us happy this week? Jordan Morris, what is making you happy this week?
Yes, I am reading a book right now that is giving me some wonderful, wonderful nostalgia feels. And if that sounds like something you would like, maybe check out Collecting the Simpsons, The Merchandise and Legacy of Our Favorite Nuclear Family by Warren Evans, James Hicks, and Lydia Hicks. This is a book about Simpsons merchandise. Niche audience for this, I realize, but if you're in this niche, I think you will love this book. I was a 90s kid. I was a Simpsons kid. I had many a Bart Simpson t-shirt, and this is just a book that takes you through the t-shirts, the video games, the comics, the cookie jars, all the insane Simpsons stuff that was being produced around the mid-90s. And yeah, it's a ton of fun. It's got a lot of interviews with writers and directors. It's got interviews with collectors. It's really fun. It's really interesting. And it does go into the bootleg Bart phenomenon, where, you know, Bart Simpson was drawn fighting in the Gulf War and playing reggae music. Yeah, a really fun trip into that time and a really gorgeous book. That is Collecting the Simpsons, The Merchandise and Legacy of Our Favorite Nuclear Family.
All right. Very good. Thank you very much, Jordan Morris. Walter Chow, what is making you happy this week?
Well, there's a new book out by the author Stephen Graham Jones, who writes horror novels. He's a Native American author. I only mention because he's so close to the culture when he writes about horror and werewolves and vampires and slashers. His new book is called The Angel of Indian Lake. It's the conclusion of a trilogy, and all three of them are about a young woman named Jade Daniels, where she wonders if she's a final girl. She's a big slasher movie fan, and she uses all the information and knowledge that she has learned from those books to survive as sort of her philosophy of living. So it's a really kind of serious look and a fun look, too, at how slasher movies are more than they first appear. They're worthy of scholarship, and I know that Mr. Jones is a great scholar of slasher films. So My Heart is a Chainsaw, Don't Fear the Reaper, and now The Angel of Indian Lake is this really frightening and bloody and all those things, but also thoughtful journey of a young woman coming to terms with the idea that she may not be a final girl, but may in fact be a trainer or a mentor for a series of final girls. If you've never read a Stephen Graham Jones books, he writes with such poetry and sensitivity. Give this a shot. I think you might be surprised. They're 90% about these really beautiful, touching, complex interpersonal relationships, and 10% the best gore you ever had.
Nice.
So, The Angel of Indian Lake by Stephen Graham Jones.
All right. Thank you very much, Walter. You guys both know me. I'm a simple girl. And this is technically speaking a repeat, but I have to speak to my enduring appreciation of the Netflix, practically not a television show, Is It Cake? Now, the thing about Is It Cake is that in a world in which you never know what you're going to get when you turn on a streaming show in particular. Is it going to be too heavy? Is it going to be too goofy? Is It Cake is a show where people look at something and try to answer the question, is it cake? It's a game show. It's hosted by Mikey Day. They have a very interesting collection of judges who come on and bakers who come on, but it doesn't really matter. It's just a bunch of repeats of the question, is it cake? Between that and the return of the Netflix show Physical 100, which is just 100 people competing to see who is the, I guess, best person, basically. And they do all kinds of like physical tasks of all different kinds. I am completely happy when it comes to Netflix things that I can watch and I don't have to pay any attention to. So that is It Cake season 3, which I believe is styled as Is It CAK3, and Physical 100 season 2, which has just started. I am an easy girl, and those things are making me happy this week. If you want links for what we recommended, plus some more recommendations, sign up for our newsletter at npr.org/popculturenewsletter. That brings us to the end of our show. Walter Chow, Jordan Morris, thank you so much for being here. I knew this was going to be a good talk.
Such a pleasure.
Yeah, thanks. This was a blast.
This episode was produced by Liz Metzger and Skylar Swenson and edited by Mike Katziff. Our supervising producer is Jessica Reedy. Hello Come In provides our theme music. Thanks for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour from NPR. I'm Linda Holmes, and we'll see you all next week.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, one of the largest recipients of NIH funding.
Dana-Farber scientists played a substantial role in developing more than half the cancer drugs approved by the FDA in the last 5 years, data through 2022. They've made one advanced cancer discovery after another for over 75 years. Dana-Farber Cancer Institute is changing lives everywhere. More at danafarber.org/everywhere. This message comes from NPR sponsor Capital One. With the Spark Cash Plus card, you earn unlimited 2% cash back on every purchase for your business. Find out more at CapitalOne.com/SparkCashPlus. Terms and conditions apply.
Jasmine Morris here from the StoryCorps podcast. Our latest season is called My Way. Stories of people who found a rhythm all their own and marched to it throughout their lives. Consequences and other people's opinions be damned. You won't believe the courage and audacity in these stories. Hear them on the StoryCorps podcast from NPR.